Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Eini Lana is on a mission to open our hearts and minds with her new book, Our Wild World.
If I was writing another chapter now, we could have more hope about generation of electricity entirely from the wind and the sun, and all that electricity being used for heating, for transport, for aviation, for all of the things that burn up so much of the fossil fuels at the moment. I mean, a complete ban on fossil fuels would be a great help, but you'd have to have something to put in its place, and certainly electricity generated properly and sustainably is a way towards it. We just need to make all these things happen much faster.
So far, 2021 has been a bad year for whales and dolphins, as more of them end up washed up on our beaches.
In the first 3 months of this year, we recorded the Irish Red and Dolphin Group Stranding Scheme 199 stranded animals. Last year, in the same period, there was 108. The year before, there was 75. The year before, there was 105. So we've nearly had a doubling of strandings this year already compared to previous years.
And we hope to solve the mystery of the crow and the cow.
So I was out walking on the road around Great Island in Cork, and I spotted these Normandy cows. They're a beautiful breed of cow. I think they're new to Ireland. They were lazing in the sunshine, and they're on one of their backs were three or four jackdaws picking the hair off the cow's back. So I got my camera and I captured the moment. And, you know, I thought I'd send it in to Mooney Goes Wild and give it to the experts and see what they would make of this video.
So, as always, a very busy programme ahead of us on Mooney Goes Wild today. Visit that website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. I'm getting my papers in order. Now, you might remember last week we spoke to a gentleman by the name of John Reedy, who has a property in County Kerry, and he sent a video and he told us an amazing story of a hooded crow which would not stop from trying to smash in through his patio doors. It had a big lump of wood which it was using as a tool, and it kept banging and banging and banging and banging. And he told us that what he was going to do was leave open the patio doors and see if the crow would come in, because I wondered, was the crow trying to get in to get at something that he didn't notice but the crow was looking at through the glass? So he said he would do that and that he would report back to us. Well, I'm delighted to say that we have John Reedy on the phone, and we have Niall Hatch. We'll be joined shortly by Richard Collins and Eini Lana. Niall, you're there. All good with you this week?
Yes, here in Greystones, enjoying the lovely weather we've had lately and watching all the nesting birds in my garden. I've got a pair of blackbirds here busily carrying food. I've got some robins going back and forth. No hooded crows, though, so I haven't had to put up with anything banging on my windows. I don't know if I'd like that too much, so I do sympathise with John's plight.
Well, let's talk to John now and find out how he's getting on. John, have you got an update for us, please?
Okay, Niall. Nice to talk to you again, Niall. Our bird, you mentioned the last time we spoke that you suspected this fellow would be highly intelligent, which I agree with you. To deter him, I threw away his stick. I threw it back into the woodpile, the heap of logs that's there, in among the rubble that you'd expect to find in the bottom of any woodpile that has been used over a number of years. And on his next visit back to the house, he became very noisy and agitated that his stick was gone, and he went and found it. Now, it took him 15 or 20 minutes, somewhere around that, rooting around and giving out, and he arrived back with a stick, and he started an onslaught of abuse on the door, and he was very upset about it altogether. So anyway, he gave up after a while, and as usual, and away with him. And to deter him, listening to all the advice I was given, I hung up curtains, blinds on the patio door. And they're the vertical blinds, and you can close them by twisting the mechanism, and they either allow you partially to view out through the door or they lock it completely. And I left him that way overnight, and he didn't come back at that door again. He came back at my bedroom window, and he had a good go at that, which I wasn't very pleased with. He'd started at 6:20 in the morning. You'd never be late for work with this fella hanging around, anyway, that's for sure. he seemed to get far more agitated than normal because he couldn't get at the garage. During the day, from early that morning that he woke me at 20 past six, I opened the garage door and I pulled the blinds, but he didn't go into the garage. He wouldn't go in. I was watching him from the sitting room on the cameras, and he didn't attempt to go into the garage at all. Later on that day, he turned his attention to one of the bedrooms in the front of the house. It was after lunchtime. I had a bit of time to sit down and was reading the news or something like that, and I heard a racket out the front of the house. When I went and investigated it, I could hear him squawking, so I turned on my phone before I got around the corner, and it appeared he had a fight with a pigeon, or killed the pigeon. I didn't see it happening, but it was in the vicinity of the window that he was at, and he was having a right go at it. There was a load of blood on the windowsill and on the ground, the concrete path underneath the window. And I've christened him, by the way. His name is Tig. And when Tig saw me, he took off. And I went and looked at the pigeon. The pigeon was still very warm. It had just recently passed away. Like, the back of the head of the pigeon had been pecked. And I put it down to Tig and himself having a fight over something. He didn't arrive here this morning. And he didn't arrive yesterday afternoon or yesterday evening. So I haven't seen him yet today. Whether he'll show up again or not tomorrow, sure, nobody knows. But putting up the curtain on the patio door upset him completely, threw his plans into disarray. Whatever it was he was trying to do, he was very upset over it.
You said you were going to leave the doors open overnight. Did you do that?
I didn't do that. What I did was I got up early in the morning and left the door open, and it didn't seem to attract him into the garage. What he did was very odd. There's two windows in that garage as well. He stood on the windowsill of the far window and he looked through the window. He didn't peck at it as normal, and he wasn't making a whole lot of noise. He was standing there looking through it. And when I came into the garage from the hallway, he saw me and took off. There is something in the garage that he's interested in, but with the door open, when I invited him in with the door open, he didn't come in for it. He's probably just being cautious, I would say. I would think that if there was no car parked here and the door was open for a period of a day or two on its own, no sign of any human being hanging around the house or moving around the house, he probably would come in. More than likely would come in, I'd say.
Niall, what do you think?
Well, John, Tig certainly sounds like a very determined crow, and he also sounds like he has some quite serious issues. It's very hard to work out what on earth is going on in his head, but he certainly seems very determined. The resourcefulness he showed in finding that stick again after you had got rid of it just shows how much that means to him. And I think that also you've actually performed a very interesting experiment to try and work out what's happening there. By closing the blinds, we can be pretty sure that Tig wasn't reacting to his own reflection, as many birds would, because obviously the blinds being closed wouldn't have hidden that reflection. In fact, it would have made it, if anything, even stronger. So it does seem that there's something inside that room that he's really intrigued about or interested in. And he was taking out his frustrations, it seems, by then attacking your bedroom window. I don't know if that was to get your attention or it was to show his frustration. But it is also very interesting that you left the door open and he still didn't go inside. So there's something very strange going on in his head. As I said, they're very intelligent birds. And with that sometimes comes psychological issues. It's very strange. I really wonder what's happening here. I've seen the photographs of the pigeon. It's a wood pigeon. And I'm really curious as to what may have happened there as well. Crows are predatory in many cases, and they will sometimes kill other birds, but it'd be quite hard for one alone to catch a wood pigeon. I have seen something similar happen, though, where pigeons have themselves accidentally crashed into windows and sometimes been killed or stunned, and then crows will feed on them at that stage. So maybe that's what happened here. But certainly it seems that Tig here has a lot of very fascinating behavior. I'm learning a lot about hooded crows just by listening to what you're describing him doing. It's really interesting stuff.
It's the first time I've found any dead birds around this house or area. There are wood pigeons living here, obviously, and they appear every now and then in the gardens. And yes, of course, it's quite possible that our friend the pigeon flew into the window and killed himself. I would prefer to believe that story because I don't suspect that one crow, especially Tig, would have been able to do it. I did look through the body of the pigeon. The only injuries to the pigeon were to the back of his head, and I photographed those. I'm not sure whether I sent them to Derek or not. And I looked through the rest of his body. There was no claw marks or there was nothing like that. So it is quite possible that it was an accidental death rather than a determined crow that put an end to the pigeon's life.
I get the impression, because of how you refer to him as Tig and the fact that you've actually christened him or her, it, let's say, that you've become very fond and connected with this bird.
Yes, Derek. I've been keeping an eye on him. I suppose, well, I'm here on my own in the house. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't have any of the dogs with me this time. And I've nothing else to take my attention away. But he intrigued me from the word go as to what was going on and why it suddenly started. I've never had this problem around this house before, where a bird would leave droppings or an accumulation of droppings, I should say, in any one area. And I have watched him from a distance. He's definitely something I think of every time I'm going out to see, is he around or is he outside or whatever. And I put the name Tig on him. I knew a lad years ago, Tig, that was his name, he was christened. And he was always trying to get in somewhere. He was never happy with what he had. He always wanted something else. So that's why I put the name Tig on him.
Will we ever solve this mystery, do you think, Niall?
I don't know that we will. I think that maybe some sort of psychoanalysis for this crow is needed. It certainly is really fascinating how intent he is. I'm saying he could be he or she is on trying to get inside this building or trying to focus its attention on something there. It really is curious. I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of it. I'll certainly be interested to hear any future updates that John will have for us on it, because I'm very keen to get to the bottom of it myself. It's not typical behavior for a crow. They are very complex. They live in very intricate and interconnected societies. They are very intelligent, as I said. So there's no accounting sometimes for what they do, but it certainly is atypical behavior. You will sometimes get crows knocking on windows, all right, but it's usually short-lived behavior. It doesn't last for a very long time. And for them to be using a tool to do this is especially interesting. So this piece of wood seems to have special significance to this crow. It's very telling that there's the accumulation of droppings outside the window as well. As we discussed last time you were on, John, that's a real sign of stress in the crow. It's a sign that he is very highly agitated. There are stress hormones coursing through his body. And this is a flight or fight response. He's lightening his body weight, at least subconsciously, so that he can respond to perhaps a threat or something that may demand urgent action. And I remember in the previous video that you sent us, this crow, Tig, was calling, it seemed, for reinforcements. He seemed to be calling other crows in and then expecting them to arrive. He was looking around very carefully for them, and he was even behaving in a subservient way, as though he's not the dominant crow himself, but he was trying to, who knows, impress them or use them for some sort of reassurance. It's hard to know, but a really interesting and psychologically complex crow, without any question at all.
Well, John, all I can say is thank you for getting back in touch with us, and please will you keep us updated if you spot anything else?
Yes, Derek, of course I will. I'm going to be here for the next couple of months, I'd say. I do suspect that he will be back, maybe this evening, maybe tomorrow. Anything of any interest, Derek, I'll get back to you and pass it on to you, definitely.
Well, thanks again, John. We'll talk to you soon. Now, Niall, while I have you here, and before we say hello to Aina and Richard, I want you to have a listen to some audio sent in by Aisling, who lives in Cork. She was on the Great Island down there when she spotted some unusual interaction between a jackdaw and a cow.
So I was out walking on the road around Great Island in Cork, and the tide was in, sun was shining. I spotted these Normandy cows. They're a beautiful breed of cow. I think they're new to Ireland. They were lazing in the sunshine, beautiful grassy green field. And there on one of their backs were three or four jackdaws picking the hair off the cow's back. She was just lying there, relaxing, enjoying the massage, is all I can say, because she was just so relaxed looking. And they were stuffing their beaks with hair, busy, busy, busy. And obviously they were going lining their nests. You know, it was just beautiful to witness nature at its most beautiful. So I got my camera and I captured the moment. And, you know, I thought I'd send it in to Mooney Goes Wild and give it to the experts and see what they would make of this video.
Thank you very much indeed, Aisling. Niall Hatch, what do you make of this?
Well, Derek, this is yet another example of the intelligence and resourcefulness of crows, because jackdaws are members of the crow family and they're very good at finding materials in their environment that will be of use to them. And in this case, as Aisling said correctly, this cattle hair would make a perfect soft lining for the insides of their nests. They're in the process of building their nests at the moment. They want to make sure that the cup of those stick nests is as insulated and as soft as possible for their eggs and then for the chicks that are going to hatch out. And animal hair makes a perfect lining for those nests. For the cattle as well, it's a benefit to them too, and that's why I think these cows were so happy to let the jackdaws do this, because they would be molting their fur at the moment. It would feel quite itchy and irritating, and so to have these jackdaws actually remove it and take it away for them, that probably felt quite nice. They wouldn't have been pulling it out at the root or anything like that. The hair already would have been loose, and this is something that that crows and a few other birds like to do. I know that quite a few people who have dogs and cats with long hair that shed quite frequently when they groom them, the advice I often give them is to go and put some of that animal hair outside in their garden so that other birds like blue tits will be able to use that to line their own nests with. But in most cases, those birds will find it in the environment. The jackdaws are clever and resourceful, so they actually get it from the source itself. They know that those cows will have hair to spare and they use it for the nest. So it really is great that Aisling was able to capture this so well. It's really, really interesting.
Absolutely fascinating, Niall. And if you, like Aisling, are out and about and you notice something and you want to pass it on to us, we'd be delighted to receive it. Take a photograph or make a little video, rte.ie/Mooney. Now we're joined by Enini Launa, who's at her home in County Clare, and Richard Collins, who's in Malahide. Aina has brought out a new book. It's called Our Wild World. And in it, Aina is on a mission to open our hearts and minds to our wonderful wild world and to help us find a balance between the needs of our everyday routines and those of our natural surroundings. The book gets into lots of stuff like what happened to the hole in the ozone layer and why are all these spiders in my house anyway? All very fascinating stuff. Richard Collins, the conch, as they say, is yours.
Anna, congratulations on a splendid book. It is a wonderful book, I must say. The name that came to mind reading it is Rachel Carson, who in 1962 wrote Silent Spring, which caused great controversy, an indictment of the way we are destroying the environment. He was talking mainly about pesticides. Well, now you're doing the same thing. This is an indictment of modern Ireland in many ways. Now, what I like about it, it's written both with imagination and feeling. And feeling is extremely important. People who write about nature or science tend to be rationalistic and dry, accurate and all that sort of thing. But you throw all that aside and you go straight in with a stream of consciousness. What is the words in the scripture? Though ye speak with the tongues of men and angels, but hath not love, ye are a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. But you are not like that. You write from the heart. The book isn't by you. It is you. I've known you for, I suppose, 45, 50 years. This book is Enini Launa. There's no distinction between you and it. It's kind of Leopold Bloom. You get inside Leopold's mind reading Ulysses. And it's rather the same here. I hope I'm not overdoing it, but I do feel very excited about it.
Good Lord, Richard, this is praise indeed from you. Thank you very much indeed. Yes, I wrote it as I think or as I speak, and it was like as if I were imagining my audience who were ordinary folks. I mean, I wasn't writing it for the likes of you and Niall Hatch and people who know so much about different wildlife things. This was for ordinary people who write into a programme quite often wanting to know what something is or what it does, or the selection of, I suppose, topics is eclectic. I have something on pollination and something on migration and something on hibernation and something on buzzwords and something on farming and something on all sorts of different things like that. So just a random, nearly in a way, collection of chapters. But each one I do feel over the years quite strongly about. If we knew more about it, we'd behave differently.
I've only two criticisms, and one is the absence of an index. So I hope the publisher will put in an index next time. I also don't like the title. It's not our world. It is the world. It is everybody's world, all the animals' worlds. And the whole drift of it is the idea that we do not own the world. Nature is not there for our use. We are part of nature, not the users of nature.
But ours doesn't necessarily mean us humans. If you look at the beginning of the thing I start talking about, we're all in this together. So it's the world of everybody, human species, other species, all of us. and I include us as just one species among many, one that may not actually survive too much longer if things go badly.
How long did it take you to do this? Handel wrote his Messiah in 23 days. How long did it take you to put that together?
Fuck, about 46. I don't know. There was something else to do last April and May when you sit down and write the thing. And the publishers were saying, come on, send another chapter. And I think there were thoughts it might be, you know, for Christmas. But then they decided to hold it then until this time of the year. So that even though there was a great pressure on me to do it earlier on in the year, then, you know, it takes a long time to go from sending in your final document to it actually coming out in hard covers, you know.
But you must have had to do a lot of fact-checking and referencing and all the rest of it. I know what it's like to write, because I do, and it's not the writing that's the problem, it's checking all the facts, and is that really true, or is that really what I thought? That sort of thing. So that would take an enormous amount of effort and time. I mean, it's extraordinary that you got through it so quickly.
Well, it does. I mean, I was doing nothing else, I suppose, for all that length of time. And goodness knows, did I check all the facts properly? I'm waiting to hear the heresies that might come in so that I can correct them for the next edition of it.
Aina, just to echo Richard's congratulations, I loved this book. It was really a revelation. I read it in one sitting, so you'll be pleased to know that I just couldn't put it down, if that's not too much of a cliche with this book. It's really interesting in it. I think that I sense certainly an exasperation there that perhaps people aren't as aware of the basic systems that run our world as they should be, and you're trying to redress that and help people to understand it. And what really impressed me was the way that you're very easily able to go from trying to explain why issues around, let's say, 5G, why people are confused or how that might affect things like COVID or why it doesn't affect COVID, vaccine skepticism, why people think that just simple recycling is going to be enough to save our planet, those kind of things. You make a very interesting statement in it that I think is very, very true. You say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Was really the reason behind writing this book was to try and put people straight exactly on how our planet works and the basic information that we all should know?
Well, it was, because that was an expression of my father's, little knowledge is a dangerous thing. You either have to have, you know, loads of knowledge or none at all. But when you think you know something and you don't really, that's when things can be very difficult. And you see, the way things are now, as you know, Niall, so many people now get their information online, they get their information on Google, they get their information on places that are not peer reviewed. So anybody can write up anything and put it up, and it can reach a huge audience, and there's no peer review or anything else. I mean, I'm sure you, as well as me, get records and people ringing in saying, oh, we have a yellow bird in our garden, or we have a yellow insect, or we have something else, and it only occurs in Patagonia. And how did this happen to be in our garden in Ireland? Because they looked up yellow bird or yellow insect online, and this is what came in. And they seem to have no critical facility to say, well, you know, this thing is probably not from Patagonia, I've probably misidentified it. It seems, you know, that this critical faculty that people should be exercising, they seem to be less and less doing this.
I think that you make some very interesting points in there. You know, when there's debates about a particular scientific point, it seems to be the way it's set up in the media that there have to be two opposing viewpoints. And even if one of them is complete nonsense, it's given equal airtime. This kind of fallacy that happens there. And I also think that there's a very interesting and worrying phenomenon at the moment with social media and with all sorts of websites and everything like that. People are really only now seeking out the information that confirms their own biases. And I think that that's really worrying, because this lack of peer review and this lack of understanding of how these systems actually work is really holding people back. And it's this foolishness of ours in a species that maybe are undoing. We're refusing to see what's staring us in the face, and we're trying to make up our own theories about things.
Yeah, I mean, I try to actually approach these serious things in a lighthearted way. So, as you said, you read through it all, and, you know, somebody on the paper today was saying that I had taken Darwin's theory of evolution and said, in short, that really what it is nature doesn't tolerate idiots, which is what happens. If you something goes wrong in the world in nature, you don't survive. So nature doesn't tolerate idiots, and yet us as a human race do. But I wanted to make it, you know, that people would read it. I wouldn't feel they had to have a degree in something to read it, or have a whole list of references they had to look up, or footnotes. I mean, I know Richard is saying there should be an index, but, you know, it's kind of difficult to do an index when it's just, as he says, a stream of consciousness nearly in one way. I don't know. But anyway, I have to say I did enjoy writing it, and so that's good at any rate.
You were letting off steam, in other words, Eamonn.
Well, no, look, Richard, I spent 20 years lecturing students in third level, and I suppose it was kind of, I was being the teacher in it to a certain extent. You know, what you should know is this, and here is the world according to Aidan Ilona, and you know, you better learn it up because there'll be an exam in this shortly. Kind of a bit of a bossy thing if I look at it disparagingly, but there you go, that's me, isn't it?
It is, yes. I have known you for 45 years and I have been to numerous lectures, and I have learned in my small way to lecture as a pupil of yours. And because we used to do teachers' courses together back in the 1970s. I saw some very, very interesting events there, which I'd better not describe on the air, but some of them are extremely interesting. I remember on one occasion a fellow started to read the newspaper at the back of the class. And you lit him out of it.
Sorry,
something
I man
would never dream to do. He didn't half crawl out of there terrified after that incident. But you were a wonderful lecturer and you kept people interested. And what tricks of the trade I've picked up, I've learned many of them from you.
Well, that was it, you see. I like communicating and giving lectures, and that's why this business of doing things on Zoom now is so frustrating, really. I mean, you can still be saying the things, but you get no feedback at all. There's no room, there's no sniggers, there's nobody even reading the newspaper, Richard, anymore. I'm not even boring people into their faces. But I suppose writing a book is somewhat like that. I mean, you put it out there and your fingers crossed that people like it and will actually go for it. But at least the book will last, whereas stuff online, things can be deleted, things can be changed. But if you've written a book, I mean, there's books since the 1500s when printing was invented. So it's up there with the immortals, my book, hopefully.
I love your use of irony and your avoidance of extreme anger. Writing books like this, you're walking a thin line between going too far. You have to be descriptive and slightly prescriptive, but you mustn't preach. You're not a preacher thundering from the rooftops. So, and I love the turn of phrases you use. You're talking about no nursing homes for slow cheetahs or short-sighted eagles. Now, that's a beautiful statement of how things that don't measure up under natural selection go to the wall. That kind of phrase makes it and stays in the mind. And you know what natural selection is from that kind of state. But I love the way you at the end, you get quite angry, but that's fair too, because you've got all the emotions there, from reflection, philosophical stuff at one end, creationism and that sort of thing, plate tectonics and so forth. At the other end, then, the problems of recycling and septic tanks and everything of this kind. So it's practical at one end, a blueprint for living, and at the other end, it is a theory of the world.
There you go. All that in 171 pages, I'm telling you. It's like the way I'd speak. Really quick, no padding, no adverbs or adjectives, just straight in at it, yeah, indeed. And at the end then, I have different scenarios. What did happen to the human race? And I'm sort of writing it as if, I don't know, I was writing from another planet or something. And I hope it doesn't come to pass that way. But I dedicated the book to my grandchildren and hope they don't blame us for the world that they will have in 50 years' time.
Well, I think it should be required reading in schools and in colleges and to people throughout, in general, every walk of life, because you've done a fascinating and really excellent job of encapsulating and explaining very complex situations and processes and cycles in a very accessible way and making them actually seem fairly simple and straightforward, which I suppose is how we have to look at these things, like the way that the greenhouse effect works when it comes to carbon dioxide, the way that carbon is stored, all of these things, and I'm making it seem clearer. I really like the way that when you talked about carbon sequestration, it essentially means trees. That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah, I did. I wrote the book for anyone that can read. So I would say fifth and sixth class in primary school, secondary school kids, and then all grown-ups as well. So it's not a children's book, and it's not a book for schools. It's a book for people who want to know about the world they live in. And that includes people learning in school for the first time and people who left school years ago and didn't learn anything about it, and everybody in between.
Obviously, you have a background for many years of lecturing about environmental issues and about biological systems. But what's really clear in this book is it doesn't come across as a lecture or as a tirade. It's almost like an exploration with the reader to try and come to some better understanding of the way that the planet works. It really is sort of like a manual to how the world runs.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd leave the conclusions to the people who read it. I explain about farming and I say, is it the best idea ever? Or I explain about genetic engineering and is that a great thing or is it the spawn of Satan? And I explain how the thing happens and then let the reader come to a conclusion about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing or whether they should be doing it or not doing it. And a lot of the time, people are not as well informed about things as they should be. I mean, there's genetic modifications, there's cis and there's trans. I mean, it sounds like God knows what, but it's really very simple. But if you know, listen and get hung up on all the jargon and, you know, you don't really understand what's going on at the very basic end of things, then, you know, it's very difficult for lay people to actually understand these things because, you know, where do you find your information? Nobody explains it from the beginning. Nobody starts off with the nuts and bolts and says, there's an acorn. It weighs 20 grams. Come back in 20 years and it'll be an oak tree that weighs a ton. Where did all the stuff come from that's now in the oak tree? And then people say, when you ask them these kind of things, oh, it came from the ground. Well, then is there a great big hole under the tree where all the stuff in the ground went up into the tree? And is it made from rain? And is it made? And then you make people actually come to the conclusion the tree is made of air, not just any old bit of the air, but the carbon that was in the air taken in by photosynthesis and stored. So even though people know what photosynthesis is, I mean, to really understand that it's the process, the only way that we can get carbon out of the atmosphere, we can put it into the atmosphere in two ways, by decomposition or by burning, but we can only take it out by photosynthesis. But I mean, that's big jargon. So if you sort of explain it in more, in, you know, more detail, then people say, God, I never knew that. So I hope everybody who reads my book will end up when they put it down and say, God, I never knew that. And I know it now.
The calculations you give for the number of trees that would be required to absorb the carbon we're producing now are horrendous, and the amount of growth that must take place to sequester the amount of carbon we're producing now and in the future is just astronomical. There is, it seems, there's very little hope we'll ever be able to do that. It's one of the more frightening chapters. You don't dwell on the horrors of it, but as you read it, you begin to see a vision opens up that is pretty terrifying.
The answer is not plant more trees. It's part of the answer. But the main answer is to stop doing it in the first place and change the way we live so that we don't put as much carbon up. You know, you don't think we can just carry on as usual and just plant more trees and that will do it. We don't have enough space on the earth to take in as much carbon out of the air that we're putting in as humans. Even the much we do in Ireland, we couldn't put enough trees in Ireland, and we have very few trees in Ireland at the moment. But even if the country was 100% covered in trees, and it couldn't be that, it still wouldn't compensate for the amount of carbon we put up each year. So we have to stop putting it up. And indeed, if I was writing another chapter now, we could have more hope about generation of electricity entirely from sustainable and, you know, sources like the wind and the sun, and all that electricity being used for heating, for transport, for aviation, for all of the things that burn up so much of the fossil fuels at the moment. I mean, a complete ban on fossil fuels would be a great help, but you'd have to have something to put in its place, and certainly electricity generated properly and sustainably is a way towards it. We just need to make all these things happen much faster.
More details about Aina's book can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of dead dolphins and whales being washed up on our beaches. This year is shaping up to be the worst since records began, according to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. This extract from a report for RTE News is by Sean McIntyre.
It's an adult pilot whale. It's a male, you can see that.
The latest in a spate of dead strandings.
It's a good 5 metre animal.
But there's even more on this beach.
Just on this 100 metres of beach, 4 dead dolphins and the dead pilot whale.
The Irish Whale and Dolphin Group says the number of dead strandings over recent weeks is unprecedented.
That report from Sean McIntyre in West Kerry, featuring Nick Massett of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, was broadcast in March of this year. April is seeing this worrying trend continue, with 2 adult and 1 juvenile Cuvier's beaked whales washed up in Donegal among the carcasses found so far
this month. We're joined now from his home in Kilrushan, County Clare, by Dr. Simon Barrow, the Chief Scientific Officer with the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. Simon, good to talk to you. How's everybody in Kilrush today?
They're great, Derek. The sun is shining and the birds are singing.
Good to hear it. Let's begin by talking about these Cuvier's beaked whales.
Cuvier's beaked whales are interesting species. They're deep diving species which live on the shelf edge in deep water. They're officially the deepest diving marine mammal species on the planet. And we've had four washed up already this year, which might not sound very many, but normally we'd only get sort of three or four during the whole year. So to get three reported in the first 3 months, it's not unprecedented. I'm not overly concerned yet, but if this carried on, then we would start raising flags up. And I suppose, Derek, the important thing about the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group stranding scheme is to look at long-term trends and identify unusual stranding events. So, for example, in 2018, we got 28 Cuvier's beaked whales washed up in a six-week period, which was unprecedented. And this same thing happened in Scotland, and it turned out to be the biggest unusual mortality event of this species anywhere in the world. And the, if you like, as the event unfolded, we detected it first in Ireland. So that is unusual. So I'm not too concerned about the ones yet, but we need to continue monitoring to see, is this going to turn into another UME, an unusual mortality event?
Simon, what are the candidate explanations for such an event? What is the prime suspect?
When we get a stranding event, we look at the pattern of the event. Is it many animals? Is it over a short period? Is it geographically isolated? Are they in good condition? Are they rotten? And it's by looking at the pattern of the event and the species involved that makes us think what could be the potential cause of it. So if they were spread over a wide area and coming in different body conditions, so fresh and rotten, then it's likely that the event is not connected. These strandings are not connected. But if it's in the same area over a short period and say it all in poor condition, then we'd be suspect these would be more connected. And typically for Cuvier's beaked whales or all the beaked whales, the prime suspect is acoustic trauma. Beaked whales are very, very sensitive to sound of certain frequencies. And the navies, not the Irish Navy, because we don't have this kind of kit, but they use active sonar, which is peaking about 38 kilohertz. And that coincides with what we think the whales use for communication. And they're particularly vulnerable. So we would flag concerns about acoustic trauma and naval exercises. And it's true that when these mass stranding events have occurred all around the world, they've nearly always been associated with naval exercises. The trouble is, in Ireland, we don't know what's happening beyond the horizon. They're not obliged to inform the Irish government about any military exercises or any use of this active sonar. So beyond the 12 miles, they can do what they like. So if you like, the stranding record give you a suggestion of what might be happening offshore. They reflect activity that's going on that we might not be aware of. So it is a big issue because, of course, when you ask navies, were you using this equipment, they won't tell you because of security. So it's a kind of long battle, I suppose, to gain trust and dialogue between things like the Irish government, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and these foreign navies. Because we're not, what we'd like them to do is avoid areas where we know are important to species that are sensitive to this gear. And we know for sure that the northwest slopes of Ireland are really good habitats for deep diving species throughout the year, but especially at certain times of year. So we would say to the Navy, avoid this area at this time of year. And by that, we'll avoid these unnecessary deaths.
Didn't they move out from the Canary Islands on the advice of whale experts because the military exercises there were causing lots of problems? The submarine detectors are doing the same thing as whales. They're sending out a pulse and it bounces off the submarine they're looking for and it comes back so they know that there's a sub there and they're able to estimate how far away it is. Now, if they send out a solar pulse, is this something kilometres long or is something that goes on for tens of kilometres or hundreds of kilometres? Is the pulse a lethal pulse that sweeps entire range of ocean?
It's likely to be tens of kilometres. Of course, the further away you are from the sound source, the less catastrophic the impact is. So to actually cause these animals to surface so fast that they get the bends and ultimately die of that, then they probably need to be within tens of kilometres. But you'll have a behavioural reaction possibly within hundreds of kilometres where they might avoid the area. And there's been some really neat controlled exposure experiments with colleagues in kind of Norway and Scotland where they put tags on the whales. They then expose them to active sonar from different distances and they look at the reaction. So it's quite well studied now. Now you need to do more work on more species, but it does show that the beaked whales, Cuvier's beaked whales, northern bottlenose whales, are particularly sensitive to this kind of activity, as are sperm whales and others. So, you know, I think we need to understand how the whales react, and then we need dialogue with the perpetrators, if you like, and an open dialogue. And I think it also pushes us into the realms of marine protected areas, which are a huge topic in Ireland now. So if we know those areas that are particularly good habitats for particular species, then maybe we should designate them as marine protected areas and have management plans that manage the events in it. So if they're only there during the summer and autumn, these activities, such as naval exercises, should not be allowed in this area for that duration. And I think this way gives it a much better management structure. And, you know, you're right, Richard, the Navy was excluded from the Canary Islands. So they're looking for other areas to carry out these naval exercises. So it's important that we identify the areas that they shouldn't be in. And maybe they can then identify areas that are less sensitive to their activities. There's actually an exercise due at the end of April. So it'll be interesting to see, will we get any increase in strandings of beaked whales during that period? I mean, it should be remembered that this year, 2021, is the worst we've ever had for the number of stranded animals on Irish coasts. In the first 3 months of this year, we recorded the Irish Randolph Group Stranding Scheme, 199 stranded animals. Last year, in the same period, there was 108. The year before, there were 75. The year before, there was 105. So we've nearly had a doubling of strandings this year already compared to previous years. And those strandings are dominated by common dolphins, not beaked whales. We've had, I think, 11 species of whales and dolphins recorded already this year. But by far, most of them are common dolphins. So there's something really strange going on with common dolphins. Some of this activity would be fisheries bycatch, and we've been concerned about this for a number of years. But it's really interesting that there's increased evidence that there's been an inshore movement of common dolphins from deep offshore waters into the coastal waters along the whole western seaboard of Europe, from the Bay of Biscay all the way up to north. So if there's more dolphins closer to shore, then you would expect more strandings because the proportion of those animals die naturally. So I think it's really important when we're talking about strandings and causes of them is to try and distinguish, if you like, the signal from the noise. What's the natural mortality? What would we expect to see? What's being caused by human activity, be it fishing, be it naval exercises? What's caused by changes in distribution? And, you know, due to climate change, we're living in unprecedented times. So if the dolphin distribution is changing to what we would expect, then we're going to see changing patterns in the strandings. And typically they would change because their prey, fish, move as well. And they're moving because water temperatures are changing. So there's quite a lot of kind of messages that come through the stranding scheme. And the challenge to us as a group is to try and tease apart things that we think have an important conservation implication and communicate our concerns and the numbers to our National Parks and Wildlife Service and government and identify management that needs to take place. So it's a case of identifying causes that we would have concern with. So it's a brilliant example. I mean, this stranding scheme is run by volunteers, citizen scientists who visit stranded animals. We train them up in how to identify, measure and take a skin sample for the genetic tissue bank, which is hosted in the Natural History Museum in Dublin. This army of citizen scientists is producing really, really good quality data that is informing conservation management. So, all power and all strength to citizen scientists throughout Ireland.
Yeah, but you can't be sure why an animal died if you don't carry out an autopsy, a post-mortem, correct?
Yeah, the lack of post-mortem programme in Ireland is disturbing in some ways. Now, in fairness, the Marine Institute of the National Parks and Wildlife Service did run a three pilot project which we won and delivered in collaboration with the regional vet lab in Cork, and this was to establish the cause of death from a sample of common dolphins, striped dolphins and harbour porpoises, and to see what proportion we attributed to fisheries bycatch. So we worked with Jim O'Donovan down the regional vet lab in Cork, and we're still working up the case history report, so we haven't finished this project yet. And you know, to be honest, distinguishing death by drowning is quite difficult pathologically. So there's an element of training and building capacity. But there's no doubt, Derek, that we need a post-mortem project in place in Ireland. We need to recover things like beaked whales in good condition for post-mortem, not just to learn about the causes of death, but to learn more about the life of the animal through diet studies and reproductive rates and contamination and age structures. So I think we could... using resources that are available through the regional vet lab, through the National Parks and Wildlife Service, through the local authority veterinary network, which is fantastic. You know, we should have a program in place where a sample of these strandings are post-mortem so we understand what's going on. Because if we decided, oh my goodness, there's a huge increase in common dolphins, what's causing it? What do we do? What are the actions? We don't really know if we don't know what the cause of death is. So it is, the two things should run in parallel. So hopefully now when we finished this pilot project and made our recommendations, that this will spark an interest in doing this kind of work, because we actually have the resources in place. It wouldn't cost a lot of money. It's really just logistics, recovering animals to vet labs, training up our vets, having a standardized procedure, maybe working with UCD as well and the vet lab there, and start building up knowledge on the cause of death and the life of these animals.
Simon, what should a member of the public do if they happen to come across a stranded whale or dolphin on a beach?
That's a good question. Yeah, we've been running the stranding scheme now for nearly 30 years. So we've got a good long-term data set. I think in the early years, we can't be too reliant on the data because there were less people involved. So there's more recording going on. But in the last 10 or 20 years now, the recording has been quite stable. You know yourself, Niall, from the bird recording schemes, you need to make sure you control the effort made to make a record. So people are sending records in online, and we have a new reporting app coming out in the next couple of weeks to make it easy for people on the ground, not just strandings, but sightings as well. And these records that you put in through the app will go straight to the database. They're then validated, which is absolutely essential if we're going to believe the data. So the stranding and sighting records are validated. And then when we're happy they are accurate, we then put them up on the website for everyone to see. So there has been a slight, I don't know if you've seen it, there's been a slight COVID effect this last year. Last year, 2020, we've had the highest number of sighting records ever sent to the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. So I think there has been a slight increase in recording effort. People are more interested. It's been slightly made easier through social media, apps, websites. But I don't think that has impacted on our trends, that we're still confident that the data, the increase in strandings is not just increased recording, it's a real effect. So it's never been easier for people to get interested involved in wildlife, get interested in wildlife recording, and to make a real difference, because these data, as you know, I mean, how many of the birdwatch recording schemes underpin really, really good policy advice? There's one just come out this week. So I think it's good for people to know that if they support our recording schemes, which are robust scientifically, the data is used, will be believed and is credible, and will go to supporting conservation actions and policies.
Simon, I have a question for you about what goes on in a school of dolphins or whales. Now, each of them is navigating by sonar. In other words, you send out a stream of pulses and the echo of those pulses coming back tells you there's an object in front and so on and so forth. Now, if you have 20, 30 such animals all sending out pulses together, there must be an almighty cacophony of sounds going out and coming back. So do they opt out? After all, if one sends out a pulse, all hear it going out, all hear it coming back. They don't need to send out their own. It's duplication, unnecessary duplication and unnecessary confusion if they all start transmitting. So Is it the case that a leader takes over, sends out the overall pulses, and the others follow him? It would explain a mass stranding. Is there anything in that theory?
Well, it's an interesting theory, and I like the way you're thinking, like a whale, a dolphin in the group. I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because when a dolphin echolocates, it then has to receive that signal back. And as you know, sound in water is omnidirectional. You don't know where it's coming from. So to achieve directionality for an animal to see, you know, where is the object that it's hit, be it a fish, a prey item, or maybe to navigate, it actually points its lower jaw. So it points its lower jaw at the returning sound, and it directs it through transmitting it along its lower jaw into its ear bones, which are situated at the very tip, the inside, if you like, of the lower jaw. So that gives it directionality. So if another animal clicked, I'm not sure you'd be able to receive that through your lower jaw as accurately. I can't see how it would quite work. So I don't think it's a case of one animal clicking and the rest listening in. I think the individual has to click to receive its own echolocations click back to itself. But of course, they don't just echolocate. They use a whole variety of vocalizations to communicate with each other, including, you know, whistles and groans and gunshots and a whole variety of sounds. And each dolphin has its own unique whistle. So they recognize themselves and they'll recognize each other's. So if they're communicating with each other to maintain that group cohesion, for example, they'll be using whistles and other vocalizations, not clicks. Clicks are really to find prey and navigate. But it's an interesting one. Do they eavesdrop on each other? Certainly predators such as killer whales would eavesdrop on the vocalizations of their prey, be them seals or dolphins. And if there's killer whales around, the dolphins stay silent, because they don't want to be eavesdropped on. And it's the same with the mother and calf. Stay quiet. Don't communicate. Maybe communicate by touching so you maintain close contact. So there obviously is an acoustic warfare going on within whales and dolphins and predator and prey. And I suppose we're only just really kind of touching on understanding how interesting and important that is. So it's a good question. I think when you're thinking whales and dolphins, you have to think acoustically, because they live in an acoustic world, which is very alien to us. So if we are going to understand how they live and the pressures they're under, we need to think acoustics, you know. And you have to remember that we're living in a generation now, an era now, where the background noise in the oceans is increasing, has been increasing for the last 50 years. So there's great concern about the impact on whales and dolphins. It could be quite subtle. It could mask the sounds they make. So maybe 50 years ago, producing sound of this energy could transmit 40 or 50 kilometres. But because with the increase in ocean sound, mainly through shipping, that same energy might only now communicate over 20 or 30 kilometres. So their sound is masked. What impact does that have on them? What impact does it have on their ability to communicate with each other, especially the big whales that might be communicating over hundreds of kilometres? And how much does that mean they have to use more energy to communicate the same levels they would have done 40, 50 years ago? And if you use more energy, you have less energy for other things. So it's a fascinating area, and it's something that there's some really good work coming out looking at sound and how it impacts on whales and dolphins. And under the Marine Strategy Framework Directive, which is a big directive out of Europe, we're actually legally obliged to understand noise and how it affects not just whales and dolphins, but fish as well. A lot of fish are very acoustic because sound is now defined as a pollutant. So we have to measure that pollutant, measure the impact of that pollutant, and ultimately control that pollutant. So that directive has opened up a whole massive amount of extra research on acoustics and the impact. So it's a fascinating subject. And as you said, really, really important.
Simon, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
And that's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to all of our contributors, Simon Barrow, Niall Hatch, Richard Collins and Dana Nilana. Our broadcast coordinator is Jara Holland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. Until next time, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild is presented and produced by Derek Mooney.